This is VOA News reporting by remote. I'm Michael Brown. U.S. President Joe Biden is launching a vaccine sprint, urging Americans to roll up their sleeves against COVID-19. The president says the nation's moving toward a summer of get-togethers and celebrations, but it first needs to pull out all the stops to meet his goal of having 70% of adults partially vaccinated by July 4th. Biden says public and private partnerships will keep finding ways of getting more people vaccinated with incentives and fun rewards, including free beer. Anheuser-Busch says it will buy Americans 21 and over a round of beers if the president's goal of 70% is met. Currently, 63% of adults have now received at least one vaccine dose. Australia's Victoria State on Wednesday extended a snap COVID-19 lockdown for a second week in Melbourne in a bid to contain an outbreak of a highly contagious virus strain first detected in India. Victoria State Acting Premier James Merlino warned the tough measures were needed or else cases could explode. He said, "We have right now 60 cases and more than 350 exposure sites, and a variant of the virus that is quicker and more contagious than we have ever seen before. The latest outbreak has been traced back to a traveler who returned from overseas. The person left the hotel quarantine in the South Australian state after testing negative, but later tested positive in Melbourne." For more news, we invite you to join us at our website, voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Michael Brown. This is VOA News. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's opponents have reached a deal to form a new governing coalition, paving the way for the ouster of the longtime Israeli leader. Opponents of Benjamin Netanyahu announced a deal late Wednesday to form a new governing coalition, setting in motion the mechanism that would end Netanyahu's long hold on power. Opposition leader Yair Lapid and his main coalition partner, Naftali Bennett, announced the deal shortly before a midnight deadline, thus avoiding what would have been a fifth election in just 2 years. Under the agreement, Lapid and Bennett will rotate as prime minister. Bennett will serve the first 2 years, with Lapid serving the final two. The deal is also historic because a small Islamist party, the United Arab League, be the first Arab party to be part of a governing coalition in Israel. The agreement still needs the approval of the Knesset, Israel's parliament. The White House says President Joe Biden will discuss with Russian President Vladimir Putin later this month the harboring of cyber attackers like those believed to have targeted meatpacking giant JBS. The White House press secretary told reporters that Biden has launched a rapid strategic review of the attack that affected JBS operations in Australia and North America. Biden will meet with his Russian counterpart in Geneva on June 16th, as tensions between the two world powers have escalated over election meddling, human rights, and Russian aggression toward Ukraine. A U.S. subsidiary of the Brazilian meat processor told the U.S. government to receive a ransom demand in the cyber attack it believes originated in Russia. The United States on Wednesday imposed sanctions on 3 Bulgarian and 64 companies linked to them over alleged corruption. The Treasury Department in a statement called the move its single biggest action targeting graft. To date, Bulgaria ranks as the European Union's most corrupt member state, according to the Transparency International Advocacy Group. And a large fire Wednesday at an oil refinery in Iran's capital, Tehran. According to state media, there were no immediate reports of casualties there. A separate incident Wednesday, Iranian naval ship sank off the coast of Oman. Firefighters on the ship continued for 24 hours before it became submerged. All 400 people were rescued, with just 20 reporting minor injuries or burns. For more news, please join us, voanews.com, also on the VOA mobile app. I'm Michael Brown reporting by remote, VOA News.
Morning Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, June 3rd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Nigeria's president responds to Twitter deleting his tweet.
I don't understand why Twitter would delete that kind of message and leave various provocative messages in which Nnamdi Kanu uses words like dead, you, against his country and against his president.
Nigerians have also been reacting on social media. We'll speak with an activist. A two-day climate conference has opened in the Liberian capital, Monrovia. The UN releases the report on ecosystem restoration ahead of World Environment Day. And Zambia's government threatens to fire striking resident doctors.
There are rules to which these doctors are not exempt from. Number one, they have no legal mandate to go on strike. Number two, they have no legal mandate to be negotiating for salaries. And number three, when they desert work for 10 days, they will be treated as deserters and they must automatically be fired.
And Zimbabweans protest COVID-19 vaccine shortages. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Nigeria's information minister says while Twitter has every right to delete the tweets of individual subscribers, President Muhammadu Buhari also has the right to tell Nigerians his thoughts on the security challenges the country has been experiencing. On Tuesday this week, President Buhari, in an apparent reference to the leader of the indigenous people of Biafra, Mazi Nnamdi Kanu, who has been preaching the secession of Biafra, Mr. Buhari says a rude shock awaits those bent on destroying the country through promoting insurrection and burning down critical national assets. Twitter deleted the post on Wednesday, saying the president's reference to the 1967 to 1970 Biafra civil war violated its policy. Information Minister Lai Mohammed says President Buhari has the right to respond to an organization that directs its members to attack the symbols of authority of the Nigerian federal government.
I think the world needs to know first what was President Muhammadu Buhari's comment. His comment was that he had lived through a war before, and he knows what a war is, and he does not want it again. For those who are recklessly provoking Nigeria to last civil war, so be treated the way they should be treated. So I do not see how that constitutes a threat to an ethnic group or constitutes a threat to anybody. So I don't understand why Twitter would delete that kind of message and leave the various provocative messages in which Nnamdi Kanu uses words like dead, you, against his country and against his president.
Bola, some people would say that President Buhari is not just an ordinary citizen, he's the president of Nigeria, and therefore he must be guided by every word that he speaks.
Yes, that is precisely why I first repeated the exact words uttered by President Muhammadu Buhari. He was speaking tough, like a reasonable president. I did not see anything unbecoming what he said, that he and some of his colleagues had gone through a war before, they're going to want it again, and those who are making reckless statements, he has been to ensure that they are handled or treated properly. I do not see how that can be considered irresponsible.
So the criticism is that perhaps the president should have spent much time on dealing with all these crises that caused the insecurity in Nigeria.
I don't agree with you. I don't understand you. If the president is daily addressing the issues of insecurity in the country, and anybody who is unbiased will notice how many times he meets publicly with the defense chiefs in order to address these issues. What people should appreciate is that what we have in Nigeria is an asymmetric war. It's not a war against outsiders. And that is why the security authorities have been very careful in the way it is handled. People who are dealing with external enemies, you know what to do. But whether it's IPOL, whether it's Boko Haram, whether it is kidnappers, these are people who live and reside among different Nigerians. So the security authorities we have to be very, very cautious. We have to be very adept in handling it. But to say that he has not spent enough time addressing Nigerian refugees, I think it's extremely, extremely unfair.
Well, let me get your view on this whole thing about Twitter and the deleting of the president's message. What's the view there officially? Do you think Twitter should do that? Because it happened to other leaders. And so is that restricting free speech from your viewpoint? What do you think?
Twitter can do whatever it's supposed to do. But my position and that of many right-wing Nigerians is that there's nothing authority given the current situation in Nigeria, whereby IPOB in particular directs its members to kill policemen, to kill soldiers, to burn police stations. I do not see anything wrong in that kind of active situation in what the president said. The government is telling everybody that is in control, is in charge, and this kind of thing will not be allowed.
Lai Mohammed is Nigeria's information minister. He was speaking with us from the capital, Abuja. Nigerians have been reacting to Twitter's decision to delete President Muhammadu Buhari's tweet that the social media group said violated its policy of incendiary language. On Tuesday this week, President Buhari threatened the indigenous people of Biafra movement with war, like the Biafra Civil War, for preaching the secession of Biafra. On social media, some Nigerians praised Twitter for deleting the tweet, while some say Twitter should have deleted the president's account altogether. Aisha Yesufu is an activist and once a member of the Bring Back Our Girls campaign. She says President Buhari's comments were done in poor taste.
Okay, for me as a Nigerian, I think it's a welcome development because it's Nigerians that were threatened by the president. In my Twitter handle, when I saw that statement yesterday immediately, I wrote on top of it that this is a terrorist statement because the president was practically threatening a certain part of the country, people from a certain part of the country, with genocide, like what happened in 1977 during the Biafran War. And that was not acceptable in any form whatsoever. And so a lot of Nigerians did report that tweet for what it was, and then it was taken down. And I hope the president learns from this and know that he cannot go around threatening people the way he does.
Aisha, I read a comment by the Minister of Information, Lai Mohammed, saying that President Buhari has every right to express his idea on the current security situation or the challenges in Nigeria.
President Muhammadu Buhari does not have the right in any way whatsoever to threaten people from any part of this country or to threaten anyone for that. And for the Minister of Information to come out and say that is quite unfortunate. And they need to know that this is a democracy. They were voted into office. They are supposed to serve. They are public servants. And they are not dictators that are supposed to lord it over citizens. Citizens put them there, and the power belongs to the citizens. And the citizens have said that this is not acceptable in any way whatsoever. Who threatens somebody with genocide? Who does that? If we had a national assembly that was truly a national assembly in a democracy, by now impeachment proceedings should have started on President Muhammadu Buhari.
Aisha, I'm sure President Buhari's comments that were deleted by Twitter were directed at this Biafra movement. So what do you make of the statements that they make sometimes?
First of all, I don't criticize the Biafra movement. I criticize the people have a right to decide that they want to leave Nigeria and legitimately ask that they want to secede. It's okay. I criticize anyone who uses arms and kill people, maim people. The unknown gunmen, absolutely, I criticize their activities in terms of killing policemen and women, burning stations, burning government offices and all of that. All of these things are condemnable, and I do condemn them. They have nothing to do with people who want to leave the effort. So the statement that was made by the president was not directed at those gunmen. It was a blanket statement to people from the region, and that we must not forget.
You also criticized the Southeast governors. For what reason?
Yeah, the Southeast governors have watched what is happening in that region and have been silent. They haven't done the things that they're supposed to do. First of all, What are they doing to protect their people? We've had military. Military have been harassing people. Military have been killing people. And because the Southeast governors have just sort of like been a whoa, I'm not taking responsibility and do the needful, a lot of non-state actors are now taking up arms and are destroying properties and are killing people, which also is not acceptable.
Aisha Yusufu is an activist and once a member of the Bring Back Our Girls campaign. She was speaking with us from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm James Mbatha in Washington. Today is Thursday, June 3rd. Ahead of World Environment Day, this Saturday, June 5th, a new report by the United Nations takes a look at what they are calling generation restoration. Levis Kavagi, the UN Environment Program's biodiversity specialist, talked to Ricky Stryak about some of the most ambitious restoration programs scheduled for the next decade in Africa.
Remember, Africa has been at the forefront of ecosystem restoration. Even as we were advocating for decade to be passed by the UN General Assembly, African ministers responsible for environment and biodiversity met in Egypt, Sharm el-Sheikh, in 2018. And they made a resolution that when the decade is finally approved, Africa should have a framework for its implementation. So they came up with what we call the Pan-African Action Agenda on Ecosystem Restoration. The Pan-African Action Agenda on Ecosystem Restoration basically looks at how to integrate biodiversity and restoration in all sectors. From forestry to fisheries to mining and manufacturing, bearing in mind that life on Earth is premised upon nature. And by taking care of nature, it is possible that we will have, we can ensure sustainability on Earth. So Africa is well geared and prepared to implement the decade. We are looking at the mega flagship restoration projects that have been taking place on the continent.
Can you tell me, please, what some of those flagship restoration projects are and where they're happening?
One is the Great Green Wall Initiative, which covers the Sahel region from Mauritania, Senegal to Djibouti in the east. A membership of 11 countries that have decided to undertake different pockets of activities along the belt from Mauritania to Djibouti. Restoring degraded lands, wetlands, and farmlands along the belt to ensure that they contribute to the livelihoods of people in that region. The second one is the Africa Forest Restoration Initiative, where African countries have pledged to restore up to 100 million hectares of forest land. We need to improve the quality of restoration. By quality, I mean, when you look at forest landscape, we're saying, let's look at the forest landscape and the services, the ecosystem services that the landscape provides, so that we are not going into a mere tree planting exercise where we have monocultures and commercial woodlots, but we have...
What are some of the main challenges?
The main challenge is, first and foremost, resources to be able to do restoration. You realize restoration is a major undertaking, and it's long-term. It's not something that you invest today and tomorrow you see the results. Often you have to invest over a 10-year period, 20-year period for you to achieve appreciable change that can start yielding the ecosystem services you desire. So it's a matter of long-term investment. Public investment alone, which has been the traditional source of funding with the development partners, is not sufficient. So we are looking at how do we expand the scope of funding to include even the private sector. But if we want to include the private sector, what are the enabling environments, the mechanisms and the incentives that will encourage the private sector also to play a key role in restoration?
That was Levis Kavagi, the United Nations Environment Programme's biodiversity specialist. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Nairobi, Kenya. A spokesperson for Zambia's ruling Patriotic Front Party says striking resident doctors will be fired if they have been on strike for up to 10 days. Antonio Mwanza says doctors do not have the legal right to go on strike in Zambia because they are considered essential employees. He said the Labor and Industrial Relations Act of Zambia prohibits essential workers from going on strike because they are there to serve the citizens. The doctors are on strike because they say the government has refused to meet their demands for payment of salaries arrears, as well as employ 500 additional doctors to ease their workload. Mwanza said the government has paid the salaries arrears only to be slapped with additional demands, which he says do not fall under the umbrella of the Resident Doctors Association, because as an association, it does not have bargaining power.
As we are speaking right now, yesterday the government did release 200 million kwacha to clear the debt that we have with some of the medical doctors. With regards to the issues of recruitment, government has been very categorical that recruitment of doctors can only be done when we have the 2021-2022 national budget. The recruitment of health practitioners or recruitment of government public service workers cannot be done at gunpoint. It must be a well-planned activity, because government still has the responsibility to look at how much we are spending as a treasury, and also to look at, do we have the space to place these doctors? They must be put on payroll, must be deployed. Where are they going to be? Places where we can take them? Do we have hospitals for them? Government has made most of these demands, and it makes no any sense. And I think there's one clear point that we need to take before you chip in, is that the Labor and Industrial Relations Act of Zambia does not allow essential workers, such as doctors and nurses, to go on ghost law. And they can be prosecuted, and if found guilty, they can be jailed for a period of 6 months.
Antonio, that's exactly what I wanted to ask you. So is it the view of your government that these doctors have no right or legal basis to strike?
First of all, they don't have any legal reason to go on strike, because they are essential workers. And according to the Labor and Industrial Relations Act of Zambia, essential workers are not allowed to disrupt public service, because they are there to save the people of Zambia. We have innocent children and innocent mothers that are dying in hospitals right now because these doctors have opted to be protesting instead of being at office. We have lost 1,200 plus people to COVID. We have over 95,000 people that have been affected with COVID-19 since the pandemic hit Zambia last year. And the numbers continue to go up. Zambia is now amongst the six countries in Africa that has got one of the highest rates of the COVID-19 infection. So at this moment, we are facing a very serious health challenge, and we don't expect that our doctors will take that route.
As you said, the government has met some of the demands. So what do you do if the doctors continue their strike? Because there's an article in the Lusaka Times that said that the Public Service Management Division is considering firing this Dr. Sampa, who is the president of the Doctors Association. Would you fire the doctors if they continue their strike?
Well, there are rules to which these doctors are not exempt from. Number one, they have no legal mandate to go on strike. Number two, they have no legal mandate to be negotiating for salaries, negotiating for conditions of service. And number three, when they desert work for 10 days, they will be treated as deserters and they must automatically be fired. So if they don't want to go back and work, if they don't want to rescind that illegal ghost law, there will be consequences in accordance with the laws of the country. We don't see any reason why, after government has made all the commitments and government has continued to release money and government has continued to liquidate their arrears, and government has gone ahead to give them a timetable which has been published, agreed upon between the doctors and the government, they have continued to defy those agreements. So if they desert work for 10 days, they face automatic dismissal. If government decides to invoke the Labor and Industrial Relations Act, then they will be prosecuted.
Antonio, it's always very nice to talk with you, and thank you.
Thank you so much.
Antonio Mwanza is media director for the ruling Patriotic Front Party of Zambia. You are speaking with us from the capital, Lusaka. Hundreds of Zimbabweans protested Wednesday about a shortage of COVID-19 vaccines as the country awaits more doses from China. The government wants to inoculate at least 60% of Zimbabwe's more than 14 million people by the end of the year, but it has struggled to get the necessary supplies. Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare.
Claudina Maneni brought her 60-year-old mother to get her second vaccine dose Wednesday at Wilkins Hospital, Zimbabwe's main COVID-19 vaccination center. She was among people who arrived at 4 a.m. but waited in vain for hours. The crowd demanded to see authorities and began to protest, but dispersed upon hearing police were on their way. Maneni says she wonders why Zimbabwe's finance minister Muthuli Ncube has not imported more vaccines to avert shortages. She says that's the problem with freebies. Shortages must affect those who want their first jabs. I hear some private points are now selling it. I will pass through to check. It must be them, government officials, taking vaccines to those places. They are not ashamed at all. There will be chaos here. Why did they call us to come for vaccination? Asked Maneni. On Wednesday, Dr. John Mangwiro, Zimbabwe's junior health minister, refused to comment. Tuesday, he told state-controlled media that government would redistribute COVID-19 vaccines from areas with lower demand to those where uptake has been high to avert current shortages. He said Zimbabwe still had more than 400,000 doses from the 1.8 million COVID-19 vaccines it got from China, Russia, and India since February. Updating media Tuesday about Zimbabwe's COVID-19 situation, Information Minister Monica Mchangwa was mum about the shortages.
As of 31st May 2021, a total of 675,678 people had received their first dose of the COVID-19 vaccine, and about 344,400 their second dose. This is across the country. Priority is being given to second doses.
After speaking, she did not field questions from reporters. Calvin Fambirai, executive director of Zimbabwe Association of Doctors for Human Rights, says his organization is worried about the COVID-19 vaccine shortages with winter season approaching the region.
The vaccine shortages could have been avoided if there was proper planning on the part of the government. Although we understand the limited availability of vaccines on the market, we have countries like South Africa which have entered into bilateral deals with manufacturers. We cannot afford to rely on donations. Government must be proactive and secure the vaccines for all Zimbabwe.
Last week, Dr. Machidiso Moeti, the World Health Organization's director for Africa, appealed for at least 20 million vaccines of second doses for everyone who received their first shots on the continent to curtail a potential third wave of COVID-19. Zimbabwe has 38,998 confirmed coronavirus infections and just under 1,600 deaths, according to the Johns Hopkins University, which tracks the global outbreak. Columbus Mavungam for VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
And that's it for this Thursday, June 3rd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Next up, the U.S. Politics Edition. We talk with political gurus John Fortier and Jim Kessler about the fate of President Joe Biden's infrastructure package, voting legislation, and his $6 trillion budget proposal for 2022, which analysts say would herald a new era of big government. That's Encounter this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Heidi Adams, host of Straight Talk Africa. Join me to explore what is now and what is next for African society, culture, and politics. We'll go behind the headlines to analyze the news and emerging trends shaping Africa today. Straight Talk Africa, every Wednesday at 18:30 UTC.
Hey, sports. sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.